The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back to Felon, True Crime Podcast. If you voted for Felon in the Australian Podcast Awards, I've got some good news. We made it. Thanks to your support, Felon was shortlisted to the 10 finalists. Some other exciting news is that True Crime Island and Bloody Murder are among the final 10 as well. If you didn't have a chance to vote, or if you heard about it too late, then there's still time. Voting for the final 10 to decide an overall winner will remain open until 11:59 p.m. Monday, the 30th of April, and then the winner will be announced on Saturday, the 5th of May, at the awards night. If you already voted in the first round, your vote still counts, and there's no need to vote again. But if you haven't voted yet and would like to support the podcast, just head over to AustralianPodcastAwards.com, click on the vote link, and follow the instructions. You'll need to complete a quick registration, and then you just need to locate the Felon thumbnail, click on it, and then click on the thumbs up icon. Once you are registered to vote, you can vote for as many podcasts as you like. If you'd like to support in another way, and also be in the running to score a Felon merch pack, then head to Instagram, locate Felon, at Felon True Crime, and check out how you can get on board the Felon campaign. All you need to do is post a photo of yourself on your account in a mask of some sort, holding up a banner containing the words, hashtag VoteFelon and AustralianPodcastAwards.com. In the text section, include hashtag VoteFelon, at Felon True Crime to tag me in it, and also AustralianPodcastAwards.com. Merch will be awarded to the most creative, and you have until the end of the month to submit your photo to be in the running.
This episode of Felon may contain disturbing content, including descriptions of violence and coarse language. Listener discretion is advised.
Darwin, the capital of the Northern Territory, is a popular holiday destination for both Australian residents and international visitors alike. Also known as Australia's tropical capital, its warm weather, nightclubs, beach markets, and laid-back lifestyle are among the many reasons why people choose to live there or visit. But behind this carefree facade hides another face of Darwin that is much more sinister. Per capita, Darwin has the highest crime rate of any Australian city, and in 2004, it would be the backdrop to a horrific crime that would be etched into its history for many years to come. 27-year-old Marshall Haritos was the local of Darwin. Marshall had a somewhat troubled background. News reports have indicated that at one point he was found to be in possession of large quantities of drugs. Marshall often stayed with his girlfriend, 18-year-old Diane Search, in an apartment block on MacKillop Street, Perap, an inner suburb of Darwin approximately 6 minutes from the CBD. On Thursday, the 29th of July, 2004, Diane Search made a concerned call to Marshall's father, asking if he had seen him recently. Diane then went on to inform him that she had not seen him since the day prior, when she had left for work. On the 1st of August, 3 days after Marshall's disappearance, there was still no sign of him, and his concerned family reported him missing to authorities. On this same day, Marshall's mother had met with his girlfriend, Diane, and the pair had both shared concerns for his well-being. The two had talked at length about their worries and were both at a loss for where he could be. By this point, they were starting to think the worst. Diane and Marshall's last interaction had not been pleasant, and with this sudden disappearance, those close to him had grown concerned that he had either run away or he had come to harm. Due to Marshall's colourful past, rumours of producing drugs, debts owed to bikies, and contract killings started to circulate locally. From the time the pair started seeing each other, in late 2003, Diane and Marshall's relationship had been volatile. Marshall and Diane had stayed together in rented accommodation in the seaside suburb of Fenny Bay. But following a series of disputes, Diane moved out on the 13th of December and left for Queensland the next day. Marshall soon followed her, and the pair spent several weeks together in Noosa. Following this time in Noosa, the two both returned to Darwin in February 2004. After arriving back in Darwin, Diane relocated to an apartment complex in the inner suburb of Perap. Although Diane lived there alone, Marshall had access to this apartment and would spend most of his free time there. He would often be at Diane's place, even when she went to work. It was here that Diane last saw him. With Marshall's sudden disappearance and no obvious leads for investigators to go on, they attempted to piece together his last known movements the best they could. On Saturday, the 24th of July, 2004, Marshall and Diane attended a dinner at a restaurant with friends. On Sunday, the 25th of July, the pair visited with Marshall's mother and sister and had lunch with them. On that same night, they had dinner with Marshall's father in the suburb of Ludmilla. The statements of all parties who had interacted with Diane and Marshall reflected that the couple appeared to be happy and were very affectionate towards each other. On Tuesday, the 27th of July, 2004, Marshall and Diane spent the evening with each other at Diane's apartment, and Marshall stayed the night. On Wednesday, the 28th of July, that morning, Diane left for work early and told police that the last time she saw Marshall, he was asleep in bed. Diane was scheduled for 3 split shifts at the Lizard Bar in the city of Darwin. The first being from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m, the second being from 11:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m, and the third from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. When she returned home between these shifts, Marshall was no longer there. With police piecing together a picture of his movements in the days leading up to his disappearance, they soon turned their questioning to the one who'd last seen him, his girlfriend, Diane. Diane informed police that following her first shift, she returned to her unit. Upon returning home, Marshall was not there. She waited overnight, and when she had still not heard from him, she contacted his father. On Thursday, the 29th of July, Diane called Marshall's father to ask if he had seen him recently. He replied that he thought he was with her, to which Diane responded, "That's bad then." Both Diane and Marshall's father agreed to let each other know if they saw him. On Friday, the 30th of July, Marshall's family made extensive inquiries and searches as to his whereabouts. Attempts to call him were fruitless, and none of his friends had seen him. Diane met with Marshall's sister Tiffany. It was at this point that she revealed something that she had not spoken to police about. On the morning that Diane had left for work, her and Marshall had become involved in an altercation. Diane had revealed that she planned to move to Cairns in Queensland. This didn't sit well with Marshall. Due to this revelation, the two became involved in a heated argument. Diane claimed that Marshall pushed her and then threw eggs at her car as she left for work. On Sunday, the 1st of August, Diane and Marshall's mother, Evelyn Robinson, met together to discuss their growing concern over his disappearance. Diane told Evelyn that she still had not seen or heard from Marshall, and that she had no idea where he could be, and that she was worried about him. On the 7th of September, just over a month since Marshall's disappearance, Diane travelled to the town of Noosa in Queensland again, the same town her and Marshall had spent time together following one of their breakups. While in Queensland, Diane remained in contact with authorities and they kept her up to date with their investigations. On the 9th of September, Diane was contacted by police members Gavin and Henry. Again, she reiterated that the last time she saw Marshall was on the morning of the 28th of July, and she still had no idea of where he could be and felt that she was unable to assist them with any further inquiries. But despite her pleading ignorance, interviews with her would continue. On the 10th of September, further inquiries were made by detectives, and again Diane claimed that she had no more information to offer them. Despite her insistence that she had shared all that she knew, these inquiries still continued. On the 29th of September, the 6th and 7th of October, Diane made follow-up witness statements to detectives. Despite her still insisting that she had no more information that she could offer, with each successive statement and interview, she was starting to let her guard down, and detectives were slowly gaining more and more information that she had not shared prior. But on the 7th of October, acting on new information obtained from Diane, police conducted an aerial search of a stretch of bushland and located the burnt-out remains of Marshall's vehicle. On the 8th and 13th of October, she was again interviewed by Queensland and Northern Territory Police, respectively. With these interviews, she finally broke down and informed police that she was in fact angry and hurt by the way Marshall had treated her, and at the time of his disappearance, she had wanted to end their relationship, and she wanted him out of her apartment and out of her life. And with this revelation also came a confession. During the first week of Marshall's disappearance, Diane had stayed with friends and did not return home to her apartment during this time. Around the time that Marshall's family reported him missing to the authorities, a close friend of Diane's, Shane Thomas, was observed purchasing a mattress from a furniture store. This mattress was then delivered to Diane's apartment. This same friend also purchased a doona and pillows from a local spotlight store, which were then given to Diane. During the course of the investigation, Shane Thomas became involved in a number of conversations regarding Marshall. The nature of these conversations were both puzzling and disturbing to his girlfriend, Kelly Harris, and it seemed to her that he knew more about Marshall's disappearance than he was letting on. With Diane now in an interview room with police and ready to make a confession, this would all now come to light. On the day that Marshall disappeared, Diane had in fact attended work. As she said, the pair had argued, Marshall had pushed her and then thrown eggs at her car. She arrived at work, angry about the situation. She returned home after her first shift, and Marshall's car was gone and he was not in the apartment. While working her second shift that same day, Diane was visited by her friend, Shane Thomas. Shane lived in the outer Darwin suburb of Palmerston, and he was in town working on a job at the Trade Development Zone. While on a break from work, he thought it would be a good opportunity to meet with Diane while she was on duty at Lizard's Bar. When arriving at the bar, Shane mentioned to Diane that he'd been trying to call her, but hadn't been able to get through. Thinking this was odd, he inquired as to why. Diane then confided in him that about a week and a half prior, her boyfriend Marshall had smashed her phone during an argument. She went on to share with Shane that at this time, Marshall had also broken her car window. Although Shane and Diane were only close friends now, they had at one point been romantically involved. In 2002, Diane and Shane were in a relationship together for around a year, and during this time, she lived with him at a block that he was living at in the town of Humpty Doo. When the two ended their relationship, they remained close friends and maintained contact regularly. Shane also stayed in touch with Diane's mother and reassured her that he would always care for Diane and would continue to look after her. Whenever Shane visited Darwin, they would catch up. When Diane met Marshall and the pair became involved in a relationship, Shane remained on the sidelines. This arrangement soon became a sore point for both men. Diane would confide in Shane whenever her and Marshall had relationship difficulties, and Shane soon came to resent the way Marshall treated her. Marshall was annoyed with the fact that Diane continued to be close friends with her ex, and this soon escalated to an animosity developing between Shane and Marshall, which would often boil over into verbal altercations between the two. On a number of occasions, Shane was in the presence of Diane when she had heated discussions with Marshall over the phone. This would soon spill over to an exchange of threats between Shane and Marshall. As Shane sat with Diane in Liz's bar, listening to her recount that her phone and her car had been damaged by Marshall, and that he'd pushed her and thrown eggs at her car, he soon became angry, and he expressed to Diane that he'd like to catch up with Marshall for a word. in regard to how he's treating Diane. When Diane's second shift ended, she left the bar with Shane, and the two made their way to Diane's apartment together. Shane hadn't seen her new place, and he expressed an interest in stopping by there before making his way home. When the two arrived at the apartment, Marshall had returned, and he was asleep in the bed. Upon seeing that he was there, Diane whispered to Shane, "Let's go," and ushered him back out the front door. When they arrived at the bottom of the stairs, Shane noted that with Marshall asleep inside her home, it would be a perfect opportunity to give him a touch-up for how he had treated her. Diane didn't disagree. Following this discussion, Diane travelled with Shane to the suburb of Woolner. In a self-contained shed in an industrial area on Charlton Court resided a mutual friend of theirs, a man by the name of Jeremiah Burns. Jeremiah was 23 years old, and he and Shane had known each other for a number of years, since being introduced by Diane. Jeremiah and Diane had attended the same high school together. Jeremiah had lived at the shed for almost a year, and he shared the living space with a flatmate. Like Shane, Jeremiah worked in the building industry, and he specialised in doing contract work in Aboriginal communities. Jeremiah was also familiar with Marshall, and the two had known each other through Diane since early 2004. When Shane and Diane had travelled to Jeremiah's home, he was still at work. While Shane and Diane were at the shed, the two discussed the situation with Marshall. Diane expressed a bitter resentment towards him for how he had treated her, and Shane lent a sympathetic ear. This discussion led to a decision about what should happen to Marshall. Shane and Diane decided that there could only be one course of action. Shane would pay him a visit and send him a message in the form of a beating. With the decision now made, Diane gave her blessing, but added, "As long as it doesn't come back on me." With Diane's approval, Shane was given the key to her MacKillop Street apartment, as well as a remote control to access the car gate at the apartment block. Diane returned to work for her third shift. With Diane now gone, Shane then gave Jeremiah a phone call and asked him to return home to his shed, stating that he needed his help for a job. When Jeremiah returned, Shane brought him up to speed with the situation. He told him that Marshall had assaulted Diane and that he needed Jeremiah's help to teach him a lesson by returning the favour. While Shane had waited for Jeremiah to return to the shed, he had collected a number of items in preparations for the ambush. Among these items was a baseball bat that belonged to Jeremiah. The bat had been a birthday present, and on it was inscribed the words, "Happy 21st birthday, stud, from all the crew, 2002. Armed with this bat, the two jumped in the car and made their way over to Diane's unit in Perap. Arriving at the apartment complex, the pair used the remote to enter the car park. They parked and exited the car. Jeremiah slid the baseball bat up his shirt and walked up to the third floor where Diane's unit was located. Shane slowly unlocked the door with the key that he had received from Diane and inched it open. The two slipped inside quietly and edged towards Diane's bedroom. Shane now motioned to Jeremiah to pass him the bat, and then he entered the bedroom first. Jeremiah followed closely behind. On the bed, Marshall lay sleeping, unaware that he now had two visitors standing over him. Shane broke the silence, yelling, "Oi, Marshall, you're not untouchable now." As Marshall tried to sit upright, Shane clenched the bat with two hands and brought it crashing down on Marshall's head. He did this multiple times with considerable force. As Marshall reeled from the blow, Shane continued to stand over him and taunt him. He handed the bat to Jeremiah, saying, "If he tries to get up, hit him." Marshall again attempted to sit upright, and seeing this, Jeremiah reacted with a hard blow to the head. This caused Marshall to move frantically around on the bed. It was at this point the attack would become much more serious. Shane moved close and pulled out an object that he had hidden from Jeremiah. With a butcher's boning knife that he had secretly taken from Jeremiah's home, he stabbed Marshall deep into his side and punctured his right lung. Blood streamed from the wound. With this escalation of violence, Jeremiah left the room and Shane followed behind. The pair remained in the unit, discussing what should be done next. But after a few minutes, Shane noticed that Marshall was still moving. Again he entered the bedroom, and again he drove the knife deep into Marshall's body. This time it was on the left side, and the knife punctured his heart. With this final savage blow, Shane crouched by the bed and held Marshall's hand until he drew his final breath and stopped moving. Upon checking Marshall's pulse, Shane confirmed that he was dead. After witnessing the stabbing of Marshall, Jeremiah went into a state of shock, and the two quickly exited the apartment and made their way back to Jeremiah's shed. While at the shed, Shane decided that the best thing to do would be to get rid of Marshall's body and any evidence that was left at the scene. Shane left the shed and travelled to his home in Palmerston. Here he collected two suitcases. He then returned to Jeremiah's shed and collected some orange plastic sheeting. Inside the sheeting, he wrapped some knives from the kitchen and a tomahawk. A friend who was visiting at the shed was curious and asked what the plastic sheet was for. Shane replied that he was just going to quarter a cow. Loading his car with the supplies, Shane and Jeremiah made their way back to Diane's apartment again. The pair pulled Marshall's body onto the plastic sheet and used it to drag him through to the bathroom. While in the bathroom, Shane used the knives and tomahawk to dismember the body, removing the arms, legs, and head from the torso. Seeing this, Jeremiah again slipped into a state of shock and became ill at the sight of blood, and he was unable to help Shane. Jeremiah cleaned the bedroom by collecting the blood-stained bedding and placed it in garbage bags. Shane used the garbage bags to wrap the body parts in. Then they packed the bags with the bedding into the suitcases and carried them down to the complex car park. Marshall was borrowing a car from a friend. It was a Holden Rodeo that was parked at the apartment complex. Shane and Jeremiah loaded his car with the cases. Shane drove Marshall's car, and Jeremiah followed behind, driving Shane's work vehicle. The two made their way to bushland at the back of Howard Springs, approximately 30 kilometers from the Darwin CBD. They pulled up in a secluded location of Girraween Road, where they then removed the suitcases and covered them with foliage, but then drove further into the bush, where Shane dumped Marshall's vehicle and set it alight. In a second trip, the two men collected the mattress and sheets, Marshall's clothing, and cleaning materials, and loaded them into Shane's work vehicle. Shane drove Jeremiah back to his shed, dropped him off, and continued on to bushland near the Elizabeth River Bridge near Palmerston. Here he dumped the evidence and set it alight. Among these items were the pieces of clothing Shane and Jeremiah had worn during the night. Upon returning to Jeremiah's shed, Shane was met by Diane, who had arrived while he was dumping the evidence. Sensing that something serious had occurred, she asked Shane what was going on, to which he replied, "It's fixed." Wanting further clarification, she asked, "What do you mean?" Shane replied, "He's gone. He's in the bush at the back of Howard Springs. The car has been burnt and the body has been buried." Diane, now confronted by the severity of Shane's claims, asked him, "What am I supposed to do now?" To which Shane replied, "Get on with your life. The problem's gone." Diane expressed concern as to how to deal with the situation if questioned by police. Shane gave her the advice that she needed to be strong and to insist that she knew nothing. He also told her not to go home for a week and suggested that she should call Marshall's father to feign ignorance of Marshall's whereabouts. The following day, she made a call to Marshall's father, expressing concern for his son. The two agreed that if they saw him, they would let each other know. Months passed, and there was still no sign of Marshall. His family still held on to the hope that he would return. After Shane's discussion with Diane on the night of the murder, he returned to where the cases had been dumped. He removed the body parts and buried them in a trench that was about 1.5 meters deep. The head was buried separately in a nearby termite mound. Shane then drove to another location in the bushland where he burnt the suitcases and Marshall's clothes. 2 days later, Shane returned to the site of the fire to conceal the signs of charring. The baseball bat that had been used in the assault was not disposed of immediately, and authorities would soon hear that a number of people saw the bat after the attack and noted dents that had not been there prior. When Shane finally disposed of it, he drove to bushland off the Arnhem Highway near Humpty Doo and hid it under a log. Finally, he used an oxyacetylene torch to melt down the boning knife that he had used to inflict the fatal wounds on Marshall. With Diane's confession came the arrests of Shane, Jeremiah, and Diane. Prior to his arrest, Shane was staying with his girlfriend, Kelly, in Sydney. It was while they were here that he had started to discuss Marshall's disappearance. When pressed by her as to what he knew about it, he told her that Marshall was dead, that he had killed him, and that he'd cut him up into 6 pieces. Upon hearing this, she became frightened, and the two never discussed the matter again. Shane travelled back to Darwin to resume work, and on the 10th of October, he was taken by police into custody. Upon hearing of his arrest, Kelly came forward with the disturbing information that Shane had shared with her, and on the 14th of October, she made an official statement. Shane was interviewed by Northern Territory Police twice. In the first, he denied knowing the whereabouts of Marshall. He commented that Diane had talked to him about the way that Marshall had treated her, and it had been a source of contention between them, but it didn't go any further than that. According to Shane, he'd heard about Marshall's disappearance from Diane, and denied having any involvement in his death. At the end of the second interview, he was officially arrested for the murder of Marshal Jarritos and was scheduled to appear in court. On the 16th of October, while detained at the Darwin Correctional Centre, Shane informed prison authorities that he wished to speak with police. Detectives Alderman and Cummins attended the prison, and during interviews with them, Shane expressed the desire to show them to Marshall's remains. Later that afternoon, Shane guided police to the bushland off Girraween Road. An initial search of the area was unsuccessful. They then escorted him to a location off the Arnhem Highway, where with Shane's guidance, they discovered the baseball bat under a fallen tree. An attempt had been made to grind off the inscribed words, but under close examination, they could be identified. Happy 21st birthday, stud. From Older Crew, 2002. Shane then led police to a location near the Elizabeth River, where police found the remains of a burnt mattress. In an area further along, Shane kicked off the top of an anthill, revealing shorts that had belonged to Marshall that he had buried when he discovered they hadn't burnt in the fire. Upon returning to the Darwin police station, Shane took part in a recorded interview. During this interview, he admitted to his part in Marshall's murder and agreed to continue assisting police in locating his remains. The next day, under the guard of police, he returned to the area bush off Girraween Road, about 100 metres from where they had originally searched. Police located Marshall's remains. With this, the local newspaper reported the following. New information leads police to murder victim's body. Darwin police believe they have found the remains of murdered man, Marshall Jarritos. The remains were found in the Girraween area near Darwin yesterday, one day after a separate police search of the area failed to turn up any evidence. Detective Superintendent David Proctor says one of the two men charged with Mr. Jarritos' murder gave them new information that led them to the body, but he says they are waiting for forensic tests to confirm the remains of those of Mr. Jarritos. Obviously, we're pleased that these remains have been discovered, he said. If it's confirmed as being Mr. Jarritos, even more so, because it does bring some closure to the family. Mr. Jarritos' sister Tiffany spoke for the family, thanking the police for their efforts since her brother disappeared in July. Although forensic tests are yet to be done, the family is certain that the remains are his. Thank you to the people who have come forward, Tiffany said. We can now bury Marshall and begin the long journey of healing. Jeremiah Burns was arrested on the turnoff to the Arnhem Highway on the 10th of October. He initially denied any knowledge of the offence, but after continued questioning, he finally made admissions to his role in Marshall's death and was arrested for the offence of murder. The following day, Monday the 11th of October, Jeremiah accompanied police to the site where the burnt-out remains of Marshall's car had been found and attempted to assist police in their search for remains and any other evidence. Despite their best efforts, they were unsuccessful in their search, and it would not be until Shane returned to the location that the remains would be found. On the 12th of October, Jeremiah continued to assist police and agreed to a detailed interview. Following her arrest, Diane Search remained in custody, and with her statement, she would also stand trial for her role, although minimal, in Marshall's grisly fate. An extract from court documents revealed the following. An examination of the remains was conducted on the 18th of October 2004 by Dr. Woodford, with the assistance of forensic scientist Damon Steptoe, who reconstructed the skull. Dr. Woodford identified 14 fractures to the face and skull. Several incised injuries were identified. Firstly, on the fifth right rib, Dr. Woodford opined that these injuries could represent sharp force penetrating injury to the right side of the chest. Secondly, the wound to the ninth thoracic vertebrae measured 5 millimeters in length and was approximately 3 millimeters in depth. Dr. Woodford believed that this injury was consistent with a stab injury. Dr. Woodford expressed the opinion that the multiple skull fractures resulted from blunt force trauma to the head, with a minimum of 3 distinct blows having to be delivered to result the fracture pattern seen. The deceased was alive at the time of the infliction of some or all of these blows. The possible effects would include impairment of conscious state, intracranial hemorrhage, and brain injury. With all three making confessions, the local news ran the following story. Teen appears in court on murder charge, Friday the 15th of October, 2004. A teenager has appeared in court charged with the murder of 27-year-old Darwin man, Marshall Jarritos. Diane Search was extradited from Queensland to the Northern Territory yesterday after the 19-year-old's arrest on the Sunshine Coast. Family and friends of Search cried as she entered the courtroom dock. There was no application for bail, and the woman will reappear in court in November. Shane Patrick Thomas, 27, and Jeremiah Nicholas Burns, 24, appeared in court earlier this week, also charged with Mr. Jarritos' murder. On the 28th of March, 2006, a follow-up story ran. Jarritos murder suspects to plead guilty. The Northern Territory Supreme Court has heard a man will plead guilty to the 2004 murder of Darwin man Marshall Heritos. Mr. Heritos was reported missing in mid-2004. His dismembered body was found 3 months later in bushland in Darwin's rural area. Today, several members of the Heritos family were in attendance. As the court heard, 27-year-old Shane Patrick Thomas would plead guilty to the murder. Co-accused, 19-year-old Diane Elise Search and 24-year-old Jeremiah Burns intend to plead guilty to manslaughter. All three defendants had originally been charged with murder. The trio will reappear in court next week to formally enter their pleas before sentencing submissions are heard. If all do plead guilty, there'll be no need for the trial, which was expected to take 8 weeks. And then a final story ran on the 11th of May, 2006. Trio jailed over Darwin man's murder. The mother of murdered Darwin man, Marshall Nicholas Heritos, says the sentences handed down to the three people convicted of killing her son are too light. About 80 people packed the Northern Territory Supreme Court to hear Justice Trevor Riley hand down the sentences. Shane Patrick Thomas, 29, will spend at least 20 years in jail for the murder of Mr. Heritos. His co-accused, Jeremiah Nicholas Burns, 26, will spend at least 5 years in prison for manslaughter, while 20-year-old Diane Elise Search, who was convicted on the same charge, will go to jail for at least 2.5 years. Evelyn Robinson was emotional as she spoke to the media outside the court this afternoon. "It's disappointing that a life is measured by such a short sentence," she said. Marshall's family appealed the sentences of Diane and Jeremiah, but after an appeal hearing, it was confirmed that the sentences would stand. It was noted that Shane Thomas had played the main role in Marshall's demise. It was said of a judge regarding Burns, "The criminal conduct of Jeremiah Burns was undoubtedly very serious. He entered the unit armed with a baseball bat and willingly engaged in the violent attack upon the defenseless deceased, but it also must be remembered that he was unaware that Thomas was carrying a knife, and he was not party to the use of the knife. The evidence of witnesses and references reflected that Burns' conduct was out of character." In regard to Diane, the judge stated, "The deceased was killed, and Search must be punished for her involvement in that killing. However, it must be recognized that the offending by Search, while undoubtedly very serious, was much lower in scale of seriousness than the offending by Burns. Search was not present and not actively involved in the physical violence. She was not involved in the cleanup or disposal of the body. Search was not aware that Thomas would seek the assistance of Burns and had no knowledge of how the bashing would be carried out. The use of weapons was not discussed or contemplated by Search." The judge found that Search was callously deceitful in her dealings with members of the family of the deceased. "I accept she acted in that way because she was fearful for her own situation and to some extent was concerned by what she knew Mr. Thomas could do. At the time of the offending, Search was only 18 years of age. She had not previously been in trouble with the law. What started out as a bashing had turned into possible implication in a killing. Search was ill-equipped to cope with the enormity of the situation and sought to distance herself by denying any knowledge of the whereabouts of the deceased. The background of the relationship between the deceased and Search was also relevant. The relationship commenced in 2003, when Search was aged 17 and the deceased 26. The relationship had a history of arguments and physical assaults, as well as reconciliation. As mentioned, about a week and a half before Search agreed to Thomas giving the deceased a bashing, the deceased had damaged her car and smashed her phone. On the morning of the attack, a further argument had occurred, during which the deceased pushed Search and threw eggs at her vehicle. Search was angry and upset." If you have been enjoying the podcast and haven't done so already, please do subscribe, rate and review. You can make a big difference. You can join us on Facebook, where there is an official Felon True Crime page, but there's also a discussion page called Friends of Felon. If you are keen to support Felon in the lead up to the Australian Podcast Awards, you still do have the opportunity to vote. If you go to AustralianPodcastAwards.com, you can see the vote icon there, or you can access that on the various social media platforms, but I will put a link to the direct voting page in the show notes. And if you do want to score some free merch, make sure you get onto Instagram and see how you can help out with the Vote Felon campaign in the lead up to the Australian Podcast Awards.
Felon, true crime, the underbelly of the land down under.